This episode of Dopey is brought to you by our friends at Aloe Recovery. Located in sunny Southern California, in Malibu and Silver Lake, Aloe was founded by our friend Bob Forrest, his friend Evan, and their friends Jared and Bob, under the idea that addicts are best treated with compassion rather than control. And I think that is true. Aloe takes pride in offering a pain-free and very comfortable detox if you're kicking alcohol or benzos or heroin. They have a staff that treats co-occurring mental health disorders, including severe mental illness. And they have amenities like you wouldn't believe, including surfing, equine therapy, sound bath meditation, and the ultra-spiritual sweat lodge. Anyway, if you're fucked and you're looking for serious help and you're willing to go to sunny Southern California to get it, I strongly suggest Aloe. This episode of Dopey is also brought to you by listeners like you in the Dopey Nation through the Dopey Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/dopeypodcast. Throw a couple bucks to keep the show super happy, joyous, and free. And I'm thinking of adding some patron-exclusive stuff, like maybe me covering Pink Floyd on Patreon. Check it out. If you guys want stickers or beanies or the new exclusive Dopey socks, Venmo me at Dopey Podcast. If you want shirts and hoodies and long sleeves, go to DopeyPodcast.com. That's all the ads I got for you guys. Here is the show. Hello and welcome to Dopey, the podcast about drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. And I am Dave, and happy New Year's, everybody. It's fucking 2020. What a time to be alive. And it was funny, I was putting the music in, and I was thinking the other day, I was hanging out with my older daughter, Nora, and she was listening to the song, and she goes, "Daddy, what's the Dopey theme song?" And I played it for her, and she goes, "That song is terrible." And lately, my daughter's been incredibly critical of me. For New Year's, we went to her friend's family's house, and I made this incredible lasagna. And she came upstairs. She was downstairs with her friends eating, and she came upstairs and announced to the whole room, she's like, "Daddy, the lasagna really isn't very good." And everybody kind of looked at me, and I was like, at first, I was like kind of squirming. But then I realized how proud I was of Nora for being so critical of me publicly, because she was being like me. She was kind of being a jerk. And I also realized that she never would have said that to anyone else. So it made me feel special. And she liked, I also made Rice Krispie treats for New Year's, and I made it with crazy chocolate chips. And she said that was a genius stroke. So I had a decent New Year's with these people, and my daughter was incredibly critical and loving of my chocolate chip Rice Krispie treats. And I have to say my cooking was like fucking pretty stellar. For the lasagna, I got the already made noodles. I got the expensive, super fresh mozzarella. I got the fucking, I made the sauce from scratch. I fucking got the super pricey Parmesan on top. It was very bubbly and brown and delicious. And the Rice Krispie treats, I was like, I had an extra half hour before New Year's, so I was just like, fuck it. I was like, I'm going to make a dessert too. And I start making the Rice Krispie treats, and I don't think I had ever made them. And I'm just winging it. I'm just throwing in Rice Krispies and adding marshmallows, adding extra butter. And Linda was all worried. She didn't think it was going to like sit in the pan right, but I'm pressing that in the pan. And then I'm like, fuck it, I have chocolate chips. And I added enough chocolate chips to like render a diabetic unconscious. But that was some seriously buttery and delicious Rice Krispie treats. And I think for my new year, I'm going to cook more. That's one thing I'm going to do. I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to make a commitment to doing things that I love to get my endorphins pumping. I am not a New Year's resolution kind of person, but like I'm starting to think about it. I'm thinking I'm going to do the classic New Year's resolution of less carbs, less sugar. So that means no more lasagna and incredible Rice Krispie treats for the new year. But I got the last year good. Maybe next New Year's I'll do it. And I want to like add stuff that makes me feel good. Do you guys do New Year's resolutions? Is that annoying to you? It's always been annoying to me. But a seed of an idea is good. I have a friend who last year committed to no fucking carbs and sugar, and he lost 30 pounds, and he's still like thin and in good shape and active. And I commend him. Bradley, I commend you. He listens. If you guys have one New Year's resolution to make, I compel you to make it to listen to more Dopey, because that's the only New Year's resolution that really matters, you know, and probably maybe stop doing heroin and stuff if you can. So for those who don't know, Dopey is the podcast about drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. It is the greatest addiction talk show that's ever been, designed to keep drug addicts company and for non-drug addicts to see the world through the eyes of a drug addict, which I am. And this episode is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be sort of an Al-Anonic episode where we have other people who aren't addicts kind of tell their experiences in dealing with addicts. Because obviously with all of the dumb shit that we've done and all of the stupid stuff that I did, you know, I had a huge impact on my family and my friends, especially my parents and in my relationships and with Linda and leading up all the way to my children. And I think if you're a drug addict, it's very rare that a drug addict doesn't impact the people around them. So this is sort of an episode in tribute to that. We're starting off with a friend of mine at work who has definitely suffered at the hands of drug addiction, even though he barely used any drugs. And even more important, it's the first Dominican to appear on Dopey. Here he is, Alex. Actually, I've just been informed that Alex is actually the third Dominican guest to have been on Dopey. So another purpose for the new year in Dopey 2020 is to make Dopey more Dominican. And we're going to start that with Alex.
What's up, Dopey Nation? What's going on?
Alex is trying to get my energy up. We are recording in an undisclosed location on the Lower East Side. I don't think anybody's ever been here where we are before, but I can't say anything more than that.
Other people have been here, but
nobody ever recorded a podcast.
Yeah.
And the walls are all fucking gray, cinder block. It looks like people were murdered in this room. Basically,
it looks like a place where you would find some of your listeners,
some of our brethren, some of the Dopey Nation. It's very dark and very gray and very unfinished and raw and lots of pipes and shit. And I've worked with Alex for basically 10 years. What's it been like, Alex, to work with such a character? Alex is a manager at a certain deli that I've worked at for a long time, and he's a dear friend. I'm going to say this before I say anything else. Alex, I got to work at Katz's fucking, I think 10 or 11 years ago. I think 11 years ago. And I came in and I started working on the back counter, and my mother was dying from leukemia. And I met everybody there. I met Alex. He didn't seem particularly great when I met him, but he was all right.
Because I don't like Dave.
You didn't like me at first? Well, Alex was getting a feel for me in the beginning. Actually, I did. I loved Alex as soon as I met him. And my mom was really sick, and she was dying, and she died like 2 months in. And nobody from the store showed up except Alex. And I realized what a special person he was. And then our friendship really blossomed, right, Al? Would you say it blossomed?
Yeah. I don't know if it was after that situation. Well, yeah.
Well,
after that situation, yeah, because you just looked at me differently because it meant so much to you that I went.
It was beautiful that you went.
Yeah.
I think you went because of Fred more than for me.
No.
But it was
It
still meant something to me. Now, Alex has seen me in all stages of addiction. At that point, I think I was just smoking weed. I went full black, back out on heroin, pills, fucking, and back again and back again, and I got sober. So, Alex, what has it been like to be witness to my addiction recovery life at Katz?
Horrible. At first, I didn't know that you were still on drugs. And then to see it later come out little by little to where it became disgusting.
Did you notice ever? You never even noticed, though.
I kind of kept quiet about it. Like, I reserved myself for a lot of things like that. Like, I had a brother who passed away from drugs, and he had years being addicted, and I didn't know how bad it was.
You mean Fermi?
Yeah, till the end.
Yeah, well, that was a terrible situation. But when I when it came out that I had been an addict and I had to go to rehab, and I had been a manager for a quick second at Katz's, and I lost it. And when I came back, Alex was so angry at me that I hadn't told him. So there's no way he knew, by the way.
No, I didn't know. The thing with me, I'm the type of person that I'll let you hang yourself. So when you see me open my arms to you and give you my trust, if you're doing something and I know you're doing something, like, I'm going to let you come to me. I'm going to let you fall on your own. Like, either come to me or fall on your own. And you kept it from me. So it was like you broke out trust by not telling me. And eventually it blew up in your face. And
well, it blew up. I mean, that's the thing about, it's very rare for an addict to not have the addiction blow up in their face. It's very, very rare.
If you see a person show you that much trust and love.
You didn't show me that much trust.
What are you talking about, Dave?
No, it was definitely not that much trust and love.
Guys,
it was a little bit of trust.
So you guys, Dave and I have these conversations, and we have this thing we call the vault. So whatever we put in the vault, nothing comes out.
Okay.
Dave has let a couple of things out. I forgive him for that. We have this thing called the vault. So if we have this thing called the vault where we keep stuff that what we speak about never comes out, then we have a special relationship where we have a trust, and you broke that trust. And that's what pissed me off. That's what hurt me. Because it's like I said, it's like if I kind of know something, I'm going to let you come to me with it. Like, I don't want to go into your business like that. And you didn't.
Well, the truth was, like, I was too far gone to go to anybody. I went to the owner of Katz's at the time. I actually met him in a coffee shop in his neighborhood. And I sat down, he's my cousin, and I sat down and I cried. And I went, and he said, well, you could come back, but you can never be a manager. You could be a waiter. And I went to rehab, and I came back, and Alex was pissed. But before all that happened, it's one of my favorite, for some reason, Alex doesn't like this story, but to me, it's one of my favorite stories of my addicted life.
I don't think it's a great story, but I'm going to definitely juice it up my style, so go ahead.
It's like, I've done a lot of stuff in my life, but one thing I've never done is really been in shape. The closest thing to being in shape was, you know, when I was smoking weed and living single at the end of my, you know, right before I actually got totally sober. That was the closest to in shape. But
by the way, that was also the most fun, Dave.
You think so?
Not really.
So fucking, this was though when I was full on junkie. I think I was probably using $300 of heroin a day. I was shooting dope before work. You know, I would get up at like 6 a.m. and take a huge shot of dope and come into work. And I was pretty out of it. And Alex lived, we both lived on the Lower East Side. Alex lived on Avenue D in the projects where I actually used to cop when I was a kid. And I lived in the Seward Park housing, which is expensive now. And we would meet on, and Alex was like, I want to go. Alex was desperate to get in shape. And
no, I was in shape at that time. I was jogging 2 miles a day because I lost a lot of weight and I was jogging 2 miles a day. By the way, whoever's listening to this, I'm a big fat dude weighing 260 pounds. I'm a hot looking guy, but at that time I was in great shape.
Well, I'd say good shape.
Yeah, I was in good shape.
Because you've got pictures from before where you were in great shape. At this point, you were trying to reclaim your glory days.
No, I was still exercising at that time.
Right, but not like you weren't fucking balls out on it. Trust me, you were not. Alex says, Dave, come meet me and we'll start running together, is what he said.
Yeah.
Not knowing how far gone I had become. You know, and the great, I don't know if it's a Spanish word or just a Dominican word for a drug addict is a tecato.
Tecato, yeah, junkie.
Is it just a Dominican word or is it a Spanish word?
I don't know. I think Puerto Ricans might use it, but everybody has their own way of saying junkie, like for Dominicans, it's tecato.
I would hear the word around my head all the time and not figure it out for many years. So Alex is like, let's go run. And I don't know why I said yes, but I was like, okay. So I put on like, I don't think I even put on any kind of clothes. I think I just wore jeans and a t-shirt. Maybe I put on sweatpants.
I think you had sweatpants. It was in the night, probably like 7, 8 o'clock.
In the morning?
No, it was in the night.
It was?
You were that high, Dave.
I just can't.
Anyway, I always had my routine where after work, you know, like at 7, 8 o'clock at night, I would go running. And Dave showed up and we start jogging. And I was actually surprised because I was in pretty good shape that Dave kept up with me the whole time.
Yeah, I was right there.
I was like boogers coming out of him. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy?
Dude, I had fucking shit coming out of every hole in my head. And I was also nodding while I was running. I was like, and I kept up. And I was like, and I was shocked that I was.
I didn't notice that you were nodding because you're kind of clumsy as it is.
Right. But like somehow, like. How many laps is a mile on that thing?
4 laps is a mile. So we did 8 laps.
We're on the track and we do like 4 laps, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm gonna do this. And we did then like on the 5th lap, that's when like the mucus really started to come out, and it was gross. I mean, it was like, and I'm like hacking, and
it was disgusting. I was trying to run away from Dave at that point.
it was fucking nasty. And then at the end of it. Like, I feel like I'm going to die. And I think I just threw up on the side of the track.
I wasn't there when you threw up.
Right. I was like so impressed with myself. And I know when we were done, I smoked a cigarette and I was like,
All right, let me tell the story because you're going off. We ran 2 miles and then, like Dave said, his boogies were coming out, everything. So after we were done running, I said goodbye to Dave. I didn't know he threw up at that time. But inside, when I was running, I was so disappointed. I'm like, how the fuck is this guy keeping up with me if I've been jogging this whole time and I was in pretty good shape?
And I had never jogged, obviously.
Yeah. And till the other days when Dave told me that he wanted to do this interview, I started thinking to myself, and I was actually happy that Dave went back on drugs because I was happy that he was on drugs. That's the only way he could beat me running.
I didn't beat you, though. I just
you didn't beat
you.
Me, but it's like for you to even keep up with somebody who's been jogging for a while and to keep up, I was disappointed in myself that you kept up the whole time.
No, that's the pain relieving effects
But I was happy that you were high because that's the only way you could have kept up.
I remember going home and standing on the terrace and smoking weed and cigarettes and getting sick to my stomach and then puking and puking and then just sitting there. And I was probably the most tired I had ever been, but I was also very proud that I had pulled it off. Now, you were talking before, though, about how serious it was with Furman. And you had been around him his whole life.
Yeah.
And he overdosed.
Yeah.
And he overdosed. Did he overdose? He overdosed before Chris.
Yeah, he did. The problem with him was he was my older brother, so he protected me from a lot of things. He would never do.
But not by blood.
Yes, blood brother.
And your blood brother, yes. But he wasn't your father's son.
Yes, he was my father's son.
Was he your mother's son?
No.
Okay.
He's Dominican. Come on.
Who's your half-brother? Okay.
But yeah, he was always very protective of me, and he would never, ever show that side of himself to anybody. And Dave used to see him come in the store, and Dave was like, I didn't think he liked me. But to Dave, nobody likes him. That's the way he looks at everybody. And Dave didn't know he had the addiction problem either. That's how much he used to keep it from everybody and hide it. And it got to points where he would not come home. He would be getting high. And there was 2 times where they had to revive him. And he would... He basically just keep on hiding it. And it got so out of hand that towards the end, when I recognized how bad it was, I didn't know what to do. And I'm not the type of person who reaches out for help. And I called Dave to speak to his wife to let him know what was going on.
Yeah, I wound up talking to his wife before he died.
Yeah.
It was right before he died.
Yeah, it was just like a couple of days. Like a couple of days before.
It was right then.
And then we finally got that call that he was in the hospital, brain dead, and they tried keeping him alive, but he was already gone.
Just terrible, terrible.
Yeah, he had 4 daughters, beautiful wife.
Yeah, totally, and terrible. And Alex grew up, basically, you grew up in the projects, yeah. Right? And you probably saw a lot of this stuff all over the place, but you never did drugs.
No, I never did drugs. I learned all my lessons from Furman as a kid. When whatever he used to do wrong, I would go the other way, and that's how it always was.
Now, when I grew up, or when I knew that where you lived was a scary place for somebody like me to be, you know, especially when I was a kid.
Yeah.
When if you know, in New York, when back then, it was very easy for somebody like me to, you know, to get their ass kicked in a place like that, or get robbed, or whatever. In terms of, because it's totally Spanish and black. Any white person needs to totally like be a part of it, or else they're totally not a part of it.
Yeah.
And you probably saw a ton of fucking terrible, terrible stuff over there.
In my neighborhood growing up, yeah. I remember as a kid, I remember one day walking home, and I saw a guy get smacked up, and I was a kid. I was scared when I took for me as a kid to see that. I was scared. I went home scared. I've remember leaving school and going to my dad's job and seeing a dead body on the street, you know, where the cops are covering the body. Like, I seen all that kind of stuff. I was actually in my apartment one day when a girl, because of drugs, owed like $40, and they killed her and threw her off the building, and luckily I didn't check.
You didn't check what? To see?
They threw the body, and it landed, and I thought it was they used to throw shit out my window all the time, and it sounded like a TV. It was like really heavy. I didn't stand up to check that night. The next morning, my mom, when I went to school, she called me, "Did you hear anything last night?" I was like, "Yeah, I heard something for, like, yeah, there's a dead body. They threw a girl." But I guess she was...
How old were you?
I was in college. I was like 18, 19.
Right. That's fucking scary, though.
Yeah.
And I know that, like, there were people that you were close with, like, in the store that, like, wound up succumbing to drugs. And, like,
yeah.
And that was PCP, too. Like, yeah. PCP is a crazy thing down here. Like, talk about, like, what it was like to watch. I mean, because Furman, like, you didn't really see him fall apart because he hid it from you.
Towards the end, yeah, he really fell apart. It was like... He would hide it, and he was very good at hiding it, because, it's like I said, even Dave, who was a junkie, didn't know he was like that towards the end when I spoke
but
to
also,
Dave.
But also, maybe you just can't spot it very well, because I was literally in the store, nodding out, eating fries off customers' table.
No, but it's
and
like...
And you didn't know that I was
No, but it's
hot.
Like I said, towards the end, you knew that you were on something. I was just letting you come
right,
to me.
Right.
And it's like...
I told everybody I was on Xanax and cold medicine. And
for any
and
of
that.
You guys, if you want something and you have a person you trust or you care, speak to them, because they may not know how to help you, but they'll try getting your help at least.
Most of these people are the people that are lying, though, the people that are listening. They're not the people that are offering help for the most part.
Yeah, so...
Well, I mean, I think the people that are listening... A lot of them
are recovering.
A lot of them are in recovery. A lot of them aren't. And then a bunch of them are friends and family of these people. Last week, I had the dude. You know the dude down the street who owns No Fun? You know,
no.
The Irish guy. He's an Irish guy. And he was talking about what it was like in the East Village in the 80s and stuff. And like in the 90s and standing.
Oh, no. This was tough. Like on Forsyth Street, that place was nothing but prostitutes, pimps back in the day, drug
dealers. You probably
dealers.
Missed that, right?
This was a fun day. It was fun. It was fun. Like, I remember the school I used to go to, the principal used to say a story that he was giving class, and across the street, not across the street, on their backyard, the building next door, he saw the SWAT team running up the fire escape and running into a building. And I was like, those are the kind of stories that we grew up with and we saw.
What was it like to watch... this guy fall apart from the PCP? Like, how quick did it happen?
It was bad, because this guy went from having his life together, having a home, having cars, spending money, and we used to hang out, have a great time. And it went from he being somebody you looked up to because he was from your neighborhood and he was doing okay, and to somebody that you had to watch out and do his job for him because he was high. Like, I remember walking in one day, going downstairs, and this guy was looking at a wall. I was like, "Hey, what's up? What's going on?" And I'll come up. By the time it was time to close, he was still downstairs, and he was in charge of the store.
Right, right.
I don't know if we want to say this. And
right, no, that's crazy, though. No, and what other weird... Because I never... That was the one drug that I never did, was PCP. When I was in college...
Yeah, it just smells like paint.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and it gave me a headache. One day he opened that in front of me, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, and he was standing like 5 feet from me, sitting down 5 feet away from me, and like, he opened it up, and the smell of that was fucking hard. It gave me a headache right away.
One time I was in college, and I was walking around in a field, and there were these two girls who were very attractive girls, and they looked like they were smoking weed. And I was like, oh, man. They were like, do you want it? Do you want a hit? I was like, yeah. And they were like, it's PCP. And I think I was like the first time, I think it was the only time in my life I ever said no to something. I was like, nah, I don't think so. And I don't know why. You know, I was doing anything else that came across my path. Yeah. But like for some reason, I had fear about PCP.
There's certain people who do whatever, and there's certain drugs that they know so bad that they'll stay away from it. It's like Steve-O. From what's his show?
Jackass.
He was talking about all the shit he did, and there was like two drugs that he stood away from. I think it was heroin was one of them, and he was like, he just knew it was so fucked up. And this guy did like the craziest shit.
Alex, do you want to tell anything else about the trauma and experience of working with me for the past 10, 11 years?
Well, with Dave is, I prefer him to be on drugs sometimes.
No, you don't.
He's the type of person Dave is a very smart person, one of the smartest people I know. And he's so insecure about himself. It's
here
like,
we go.
No, Dave, I'm not trying to bring you down.
Dude, do your thing. I'm here, do your thing.
It's like Dave could be doing something and he knows he's doing it the right way. And he'll ask me 1,000 times if he's doing okay. I'm like, yo, Dave, what the fuck? Yo, I already told you yes, right? And he's going to keep on asking over and over again. And when he was on drugs, he would just do it.
Have you ever, in all of your time, have you ever come into contact with somebody like me in this place, though?
No.
Well, that's good.
As annoying as you? No, no.
anything else you want to share about the incredible experience of working with me?
Working with Dave? No, no.
That's it?
Yeah, that's about it, Dave.
All right, thanks, Al. So that was my very, very good friend, Alex, who I love and totally appreciate getting to work with. And Alex saw me in some of my fucking worst moments ever. And it's so nice to be, I don't know if I'm at my best that I've ever been, but I probably am. And I like that. And it's good for work. And it's good for Dopey. And it's good for the family. And for me, fucking 12-step got me here. Because I never would have gotten fucking clean without 12-step. But some of you might hate 12-step. Some of you might want to find another way, which is where the great alt-recovery movement comes in. If you want to get sober and you're scared of, like, going to a meeting or you don't want to pray to God, and I recommend going to a meeting and praying to God. But if you don't want to do that, there's any way in. And I got a voicemail recently from this dude who talked serious alt-recovery movement, and I want to play it for you guys. A nice, dopey voicemail.
Hey, Dave. Love the show, man. Great show. It's done a lot for my recovery. Been sober 2 years now. Just listening to episode 212. Man, I want a t-shirt with Dopey on the front and alt recovery on the back. I think that'd be great. Got a bunch of dopey stories. I'll send them to you some other time. I'm on my way. Well, I don't want to tell you where I'm going, but I'm on my way somewhere, so I'll have to talk to you later. But I'm not going to get drugs. All right, I'm actually on the way to the doctor. Going to get my Suboxone. Been in active addiction for like, I don't know, 15 years. Lost like 8 years with my wife. Wasn't around for about 8 years of my daughter's life or my son's. But hey, man, I've got 2 years. 2 years being a productive member of society. I'm a general manager of a store, so I've got my own store. There was an owner crazy enough to give a felon and ex-drug addict a chance to run a store. And, you know, everything's going really good. And I think that's, like, part of the alt recovery. You know, like, if I go to AA, they're going to... I can't tell them I'm taking Suboxone. They're not going to tell me I'm clean, which I think's really fucked up because... The old me and who I am today is two totally different people. But, you know, anyways, I'll send you some dopey shit some other time. Stay strong. Toodles for Chris.
So I love that voicemail. And the point of it is just that if you're happy and you're not underneath the fucking mountain of misery in terms of drug addiction, then that's great. It's all about your quality of life and your happiness. And if you find happiness and productivity on Suboxone or on methadone, then more power to you. You know, I just advocate for people not to be fucking victims of drug addiction. And that's the whole point of the alt recovery movement. But equally important, this guy alluded to having some dopey stories that he will tell at a later date. If you're sitting out there listening to Dopey, thinking that you have the fucking ultimate hit him with the dopey story, then what are you doing, man? Man, woman, child, boy, girl. If you have the fucking, the stuff, the hit him with the dopey stuff, the kill, the dank, the whatever you, the fire fucking dopey story, please send it in to dopeypodcast@gmail.com. Dopey is not dopey without the real good dopey stories. So please send them in and keep them at around 6 or 7 minutes. Nobody wants to hear any more than that. Unless it's fucking amazing, 6 or 7 minutes is the sweet spot. So up next, we have someone who's definitely been impacted by drug addiction as our Al-Anon episode rolls forward. She hosts and produces a very, very big up-and-coming podcast called Last Day. She is totally a member of the Dopey Nation. Her name is Stephanie Whittles Wax. She's actually been on the show before. So without further ado, here she is. Okay, so this is very exciting. This is the Al-Anonic episode of Dopey. And I think this woman has been on the show before. Her name is Stephanie Whittles Wax. She had a very famous brother who unfortunately died from heroin overdose named Harris Whittles. Stephanie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
This is really like it's weird for me because Stephanie and I are recording this through this an obvious technological thing where she records in Texas and I record in Manhattan. But when I look at my fucking screen, I don't see your sound and I get all paranoid. So just, it's going to be a thing, just so you know.
I hear you. I understand and I share your anxiety around that.
Do you ever record in person with people?
Never. I mean, because I live in Texas. Who the fuck is in Texas? So no.
Which town do you live in?
Houston.
I'm sure there's somebody there. I'm sure somebody is like struggling from a drug. See, that's what you should see. Stephanie does this amazing podcast called Last Day. Why don't you tell the dopey? You see, I feel like our podcasts are these weird mirror images of each other where Dopey is about like drug addiction, you know, and I was a drug addict or am a drug addict. And why don't you tell people about what Last Day is about? Because I don't think I would do it justice the same way.
Well, now there's a lot of pressure for me to do it well. So
give me a break.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, so essentially, I'm going to like rewind a little bit, and then I'll tell you what the show is about. But I lost my brother in 2015, and it was horrible and the worst thing ever. And I wrote a book about it, if you want to read it. And I was kind of done talking about, thinking about, processing Harris's death, and I wanted to not spend my entire life thinking about drugs as somebody who had never been addicted to drugs before, and yet they'd had this like massive impact on me and my family. And so I had one kid, and then I was pregnant with the second kid, and I think that's when I came on your show, which was like in April of 2018. And around that time, this woman had reached out to me who was the executive producer of another show called Pod Save the People with DeRay McKesson. And she, like, that show is huge, and she wanted to see if I wanted to come on to be a guest on the show. And we got on the phone, and it turns out that she had lost her brother at the end of 2017 to a fentanyl overdose. And
but she knew the similarities between your stories before she had you on, right?
Yeah. So like she kind of like cold outreached to me, and had read the book and had heard me on another show that I went on with my mom. This is like a lot of podcasting stuff. I'm really sorry. I'm like probably convoluting this. But there's a show called Terrible Thanks for Asking, and also a great show, and she had heard me on that show like 3 months after her brother died, and the way she describes it is that my mom and I were in the studio, we were laughing, we were being ourselves, also grieving and hating everything, but like as us, and it was the first time that she was able to smile and laugh and feel like I'm a human again. It was like this big moment for her, and she wanted to reach out and be like, hey, we have the same lived experience, you know? And like, as we were having this conversation, I hate talking on the phone. Truly, it's my least favorite thing to do. And I loved talking to her. Like, we just had all of this overlap and, you know, we got along really well. And like at the very end of the call, she was like, hey, I have this idea to do a show about the opioids crisis. Like, are you interested in that? And I was truly a week away from giving birth and giant and not super interested in that.
Right.
To be honest, I was like, maybe, you know, like.
Oh, you weren't really interested in doing a show about opioid addiction when you were about to have a baby? That doesn't make any sense at all.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, I was like, not so much. I could think of other things I'd want to do more. And hung up the phone and was like, I really like that woman. You know, I remember thinking like, she sounds great. Sucks that she is going through this same thing that I went through. That's terrible. And I kind of like put it away, and my son was born, and like we had a bunch of other shit we were dealing with at the time. And then like a few months later, I was scrolling through the internet and I hit this thing that said opioids are killing more people now than car accidents. And I don't know. I just had like a flip switched or switch flipped or whatever that is. I always get it wrong. And I emailed her immediately and I was like, hey, I totally don't want to do this show for all the reasons that I should do this show. And so let's do the show. Like,
right.
It was like this weird, like, I think you called it like a white light moment. It's not, you know, it was just like this, like, I don't have a choice here. I need to do this. And, I don't know. We started working on it and, you know, once we sort of like had a plan, it's like, well, how do we do a show about the opioids crisis that anyone would want to listen to, you know? And like, what is the point of the show? And how do we tell the story of the crisis in a way that's human? Because I'm not a reporter. I mean, I come from an arts background. I'm not like a journalist.
Well, you do it in a sort of arty journalistic way. And I think Dopey has totally set the table on how to cover the opioid epidemic in an entertaining way.
Absolutely.
So I think we proved that it was doable.
That's right.
And like, it's like, you know how like in Stranger Things, like you have like the real world and then the upside down?
Yes, I do.
I feel like that's Last Day and Dopey.
Yes.
Like, and I think we're probably the upside down. And what I mean
what
is,
if
like,
what if I had said to you, "What's Stranger Things? Like, would you well, hang that, up that, on me? Would you just
no?
Hang
it's
up?
This. It's a. It's this amazing show on Netflix that's nostalgic and kind of talks. You know, no, I would have told you exactly what it was.
Good. Okay, good.
But fucking, I feel like Last Day looks at the opioid epidemic in this very responsible and journalistic way that is also incredibly emotional. And I was listening to the latest episode this morning. It was about handling the holidays. And I was hearing all these voicemails. And we get voicemails too, but we get like the opposite voicemails. It's like the total opposite show. But both of our shows are speaking to people that have shared experiences, which is really like, I guess, is the point of podcasts.
Yeah.
Is that you can put something on in your head and feel like you're being kept company by it.
Well, and that is exactly, like, we always said, we were like, okay, this show is not, it was never just content. It was always content and community. Like, it had to be both. And I think what, for me, like, when I wrote my book, I started getting, I mean, I this sounds like I'm fucking, I'm like, so many people reached out to me. But, like, people would email me the worst stories. Like, the most heartbreaking, tragic stories. And they'd be like, hey, this is something I lived through and no one is talking about it. And I want to tell you about it because you understand it. Right. And it was like, oh, okay. So everyone is suffering, basically, is what is happening. Like, everyone that is alive is suffering in some kind of a way. And I don't know.
Well, that's what Buddha says. Life is suffering.
To live is to suffer. Absolutely.
That's the deal.
And that
is the great Jewish Buddhist thought.
That is life is suffering. Yeah, that is what it is to be a fucking human, is that you are suffering at every moment, and how do we make the most of that? And for me, it's like, I don't know, like once I decided to do the shows, it became this thing that I thought I was done, but what I was done with was my own personal, like, grieving process. Like, I feel like I have grieved and grieved and grieved and grieved. Like, I'm like professionally, like, I could have a degree in grief at this point. Like, I have fucking grieved. And I was done with that part of it. But what I hadn't done yet, and what I didn't realize I needed to do before I took on the show, is that I needed to, like, understand what my brother was going through. I needed to understand addiction in a way that I didn't before. And I needed to, like, I have a very activist spirit. Like, I have two kids with varying degrees of hearing loss and deafness. And, like, I got a bill passed in Texas that, like, covers hearing aids and cochlear implants for kids. Because, like, they weren't.
Amazing.
And I was like, well, that's fucked up. And, like, I'm going to fix that. And, like, that's just, I'm very driven by injustice. And so I just felt like, oh, I don't want people to die. I don't want people to be going through this. And no one seems to be able to figure out, like, how do we stop these numbers from getting up there? And I don't want to make it sound like I am finding the solution, because that is absolutely not what the show promises to be. But we do talk about every aspect of it in a way that is helping me to understand, like, as I do the show, I'm understanding more what addiction is, what my brother was going through, what are some, like, data points, what are some proven ways that people have found to be helpful, like, what's going on with treatment and recovery. Because, like, in my experience with him, he went to 3 30-day programs, and he used every single time he got out, and I never understood that. And, you know, so, like, I'm kind of, like, putting the pieces together in this way that it's, like, interesting what's happening. I didn't expect this, but, like, when I started the show, I thought, oh, I know everything about this, and I feel like I did everything we could do, and this is going to be for other people, right? But, like, as I've been doing the show, I'm like, oh, I see so many things that I didn't know then, and, like, this weird guilt is starting to creep up. And it's not like I could have stopped him from dying, but it's like whenever you have more understanding of a thing than you had before, like, there's part of you that's like, oh, well, shit, I wish I would have known this then, because then maybe we could have had a different outcome. And my dad he's retired, but he was a doctor, like a general medicine doctor, family doctor. And he said to me last night, this is what's frustrating about medicine, is that, like, you're constantly having these innovations that come up, and people are always breaking new science things. And it's frustrating because you're like, oh, if I would have had that treatment 5 years ago, then this, you know?
I know, but it's like, I feel like as somebody who is in recovery and as somebody who is a heroin addict and somebody who lost two of my best friends to this, I don't think, this is so fucked up to say, but I don't know that innovations will save every addict's life. You know, an addict wants to get high. An addict doesn't necessarily want to be on Suboxone. An addict doesn't necessarily want to be on methadone. An addict doesn't necessarily want to get clean. And as much as we want them to, it's like, it just sucks.
Yeah.
You know, it sucks that Harris had to die. I think my favorite thing about Last Day is that what you're doing is creating this community of survivors who feel like they belong someplace. You give them, like, a safe place to feel like they belong.
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like, you know, Dopey is a fucked up pseudo safe place, because, like, obviously Chris died, Todd died, a bunch of our listeners died, and a bunch more probably died that we don't know about. And I know that our audience feels at home listening to the show because they know that we're on the same page, and we've been through similar things. And I feel like that's the same thing with Last Day, only with Last Day, you cover so many different walks of life and so many different angles of the opioid epidemic. But for me, the most powerful thing is to hear the stories of people who survived their family passing and still live. You know what I mean? Like, you're obviously, you say that you grieved and grieved and grieved. You're still grieving, just the grieving changed. It went from inside to out, right?
Totally. I mean, I started my conversation with you when we weren't on the microphone, like, telling you, it's like fascinating when you think that you are done, you know, like,
right,
how it just can come up and be as intense and powerful as it was 5 years ago. You know, like, I had a moment last night where I just like snapped, you know, like, we had a big thing with my mom. It was her birthday. It was Hanukkah. The holidays were like a big thing with my family. Like, obviously the holidays are fucking big thing for every family, duh. But like, it was just like, I was like, oh, I feel joy today. Like, whenever I can feel joy at a family thing and not constantly be thinking about how there's an emptiness there, that is notable. And like, the notable thing for me yesterday was that I wasn't thinking all day about how Harris wasn't there. I was just in the moment of what was going right on. Like, I was just with my family. My fucking kids were being as amazing as they are. I was like drinking it in. I was like feeling great. And then once everyone had gone to bed and I was like in my kitchen by myself and I was listening to some of your stuff, actually. So thanks so much. And
yes, you're welcome.
I was like, you know, it was just quiet. And then I thought, oh, I felt good today. I just like lost it, you know, and I just was like weeping. And then I like went upstairs and I never do this. I never, like, I'm a very solitary griever, shockingly. But like, I went upstairs because I was like, I'm going to go like be hugged by my husband, you know, and his ass was like so fucking passed out. Like, he was like snoring and dead, you know, not really, yes, but like, you know what I mean? And I was like, all right. So I like got it together. And then this morning I was like, man, I really needed a hug last night, Mike. Like, thank you for passing out in all of your clothes at 10 o'clock. But yeah, like,
I think I fell asleep in all of my clothes at 9 last night. So yeah, at least Mike had an extra hour on me, which is good.
Yeah. So like, you know, yeah, it never ends. And I will say that, like, I don't read the reviews of our show because it's just not helpful for me personally to do. But my producer sent me this review last week, and I'm going to read it because I feel like it is, like, the whole point of why we're doing it. And it, like,
nice,
really, truly fueled me with, like, more energy than I maybe have ever had. Okay, so it says, I have a family member who has struggled with opioid addiction for the past 16 years. Through the recommendation of this podcast, my family and I have been transformed in the way we support, communicate, and care for our loved one. Prior to listening to this podcast, my family and I were preparing to have an intervention. However, because of this podcast, we've been encouraged to shift our support to stretch to a depth that we never thought capable. Our family member is now working with a medication-assisted treatment program that we incidentally found because of the show. I can't stress enough the importance of this reporting and what your hard work has done for our family. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Eternally grateful to you and your team for all the hours and heart that you've poured out.
Amazing.
I mean, yeah, like, I was like, okay, like, that just is everything. I was like, okay, good. I'm like, that is why I want to do this, because I feel like that person's life is better now, you know? Like,
right, and more than just providing community, you actually provided a plan,
yeah,
you know, for somebody to be in less risk, which
right
is amazing.
Right, because I think that's the thing. It's like, for people who are in recovery, And I never went to an Al-Anon meeting. I never went to one Al-Anon meeting, probably should have. But, like, I did not know what to do. Like, this is the thing. Like, my brother was my best friend, right? Like, I was always there for him. He would call me at 2 a.m. to be like, hey, this girl just ran out of my house because I'm a shithead, you know? And I'd be like, yeah, of course she did. Like, you're a shithead. You know, like, that was our dynamic. And then,
right,
like, this came up and I was like, I do not know what to do. And I think families feel that. They're like, I want to support them. I want to love them through it. But like, what the fuck does that mean? What does it look like? Like, can you give me a plan? Can you give me like a list of things to do? And if I if Harris was still alive and I could listen to a show that would kind of like give me some sort of a roadmap, that would have been like a game changer for me. Because I wanted information and I didn't know where to get it. And, you know,
the only information that Dopey gives is like, eat chocolate and watch Lord of the Rings if you're going through withdrawal. That's like the only thing that an addict gets from Dopey. So I think you're really serving the community, maybe better than we are.
No.
So that's good.
Yeah. Anyway.
But no, I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is like, because like when you said, I want to try to reduce the death count, I was like, give me a break.
Yeah.
But like in all honesty, you are, you know, people are dying less because you are sending them. Like I often, when Chris was still alive, I would like talk shit about medicated assisted treatment because whenever I was on it, I would use at the same time. That doesn't mean that somebody who's on medicated assisted treatment and is actually doing it the right way, you know, it could work for them, you know. And I changed everything about my take on all of it after Chris died, where it was just became quality of life stuff. You know
totally,
what I mean?
Totally, yes.
And it seemed, and I've heard you talk about that on Last Day also, but it's also like with Dopey, like let's say you're a family member or a friend tuning into Dopey, you have to suffer all this ridiculous shit to get to something good. I mean, most of the people say the redeeming thing is that, oh, I guess my brother wasn't just an asshole, or you guys are funny and it reminds me of him or whatever. In your situation, you're actually in a sober and well-informed way laying the pavement for where they can walk. And that's an amazing service.
Thank you. Thank you. That is very nice of you to say. Thank you.
I'm proud of you, Stephanie. And I know that, like, it's just nobody, like, Harris didn't intend to die. I didn't know him. But from what I understand, like, I don't think he intended on dying.
Oh, and, God, like, no. He didn't think he would ever. He didn't think he would die. That was not part of his plan. No.
And what are you hearing? Are you getting a, because, like, I read all the reviews. And I get crazy obsessed with the negative reviews.
Oh my God.
To the point where now I have my father read the negative reviews on the show. Because I know it gets him more upset, and I can get less upset if he gets more upset. That's always fun for me.
Oh, juice. Yes.
Yeah, I know. Yes. It's a good time. You know, I think that's interesting actually, because I was just, I was listening to the Last Day holiday, how to handle the holidays, and Stephanie told a story about her father. Why don't you tell a little bit about that to the Dopey world? I think they'd like that.
Yeah. So, okay. So we are Jewish, 100%. Literally, like, we got the DNA test. We are 100% Eastern European Jews. And, but my dad, like, is a total weirdo, mostly in a good way. And he always felt just so alienated, you know, growing up. Like, he didn't do the Christmas thing, and he felt like, I don't want my kids to feel totally alienated and weird. And so he started doing these letters from Santa when we were really young. I was like 3 or 4. And they turned into, like, my dad is not a speaker of feelings. I mean, he's very limited in his capacity to talk about how he feels. My mother, on the other hand, is like, you know, Jewish woman, Southern Belle. Like, she's just constantly voicing everything. And so these Santa letters became this one time of the year when my dad could tell us how he thought about us, like how he felt about us and how he was proud of us. And it sounds so, like, cheesy when I'm saying it out loud, but it's like, we really needed it, you know? We really depended on this. And they became this really huge thing in our family. And my dad would spend a lot of time on them. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I love that. I just want to know, at what point did you and Harris realize it was your dad?
Oh, God. I mean, really early. I probably, like, when we were in middle school, maybe, you know? Or maybe, like, late elementary school. It, like, became very clear that it was my dad. And also, like, the letters were hilarious. I mean, Santa was like they would never fly in Me Too America.
Like, right.
Super raunchy. Like, he just talked about, like, having sex constantly with Mrs. Claus. And he was, like, super illiterate. Like, he was, like, this dummy. I don't know. It was like they were hilarious.
Your dad was really like, he was like really channeling a character of Santa.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
like
funny.
This lecherous, illiterate Santa. And, but then they would be very tender. You know, it was like this really funny thing. And then it was like very profound and meaningful. And we did them every year. And I would always read them out loud. And everyone would, like Harris would sit where he sat in the room and everyone sort of like assumed the position. And the last letter that my dad wrote was in 2014. It was, Harris died in February 2015. So this was December. This was like 6 weeks earlier. And it was like this heartbreaking letter where he was like, Harris has struggled. Harris, you know, we love Harris. We support him. And one thing is clear from this year that, like, as hard as it's been, we've all been here for each other. And we love each other. And 2015 is going to be better. And
right.
It wasn't. Harris died. And I died spiritually. And, you know, my husband is, like, still, like, to this day, he's, like, very resentful that he has now taken over this Jewish Santa tradition because he's like, why the fuck am I doing, like, Christmas? Like, I am a Jew. Like, this, why did I marry into this weird Christian Jewish family?
That's so funny.
But he, like, took it over, and he writes beautifully. And so now he writes these letters to from Santa. You know, he wrote the first one in 2015, the year Harris died. And it's like I hear you talking about how you like continue to do the show and like you keep doing the tradition. You know, it's like I needed that thing to keep going. Like we needed it to keep going. And, you know, now it's 5 years later and like literally yesterday he's like, God damn it, I have to write this fucking letter, you know?
Dude, fucking, I actually basically married into a non-Jewish family, and, like, the only condition was that I don't blow the lid on Santa for our kids. Like, that's, like, and, like, my daughter's still asking me, she's like, why does Aunt Lori say Santa is fake? And I'm like, and I just want to be like, she's fake, it's done, it doesn't mean anything, you know, we're Jewish, right. This is bullshit. But I'm like, oh, Aunt Lori doesn't really know about Santa.
Right.
She doesn't know his magic. But how, you know, but I was also a Jew who loved Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
I loved Christmas.
Oh, my God,
forever.
Me too. What Jew doesn't love Christmas? Please. They tell you they don't love it. They're a fucking liar is what they are.
They're just jealous.
They're just jealous.
Yeah. The question is, though, like, did your dad stop writing because the grief with Harris too much for him to ever write another Santa letter?
Yeah. He can't do it. My dad has not, like, spent 1 minute in therapy, you know, like, ever in his life. And if you ask him, like, why Harris is dead, he would say it's because of me. Like, he would blame himself still. Like, he's just very...
Well, how does he figure that? How could he possibly think it's his fault?
Because in his mind, it's this very simplistic thing that, like, a parent is supposed to protect a kid, and
right.
His kid is dead. And so that somehow means that he did something wrong. And, like, he will take that shit back to, like, when they went on a camping trip when they were 8. I mean, he's
right.
Just very...
He'll cite the moment that he failed or something,
yes,
and then
yes,
he knew.
Yes.
You know,
and
Chris's father is sober like 30 years, and they were always kind of expecting him to die. And not that they were expecting him to die when he died, and they were totally shocked and devastated, but like it wasn't, I don't think they carried it the same way like that.
Yeah. I mean, my dad there has been a genuine. Deterioration, I would say. Mm. Like he, my dad worked like 40 years every day, you know, like he worked and worked and worked and then he retired. And this happens to a lot, I think, of guys from his generation where they like retire and then they do not know who they are. They have no hobbies. Like work was the thing that they did forever. And that happened to my dad. But then I think the also like just like not having Harris there and he got Parkinson's and like it just,
oh my God,
I know. Like it just, he just really But I do think that the thing like about Parkinson's too is that it's a terrible disease and it does terrible things to you. But the way that you can kind of like help to maintain that is that you have to continue being active. Like if you're like laying in bed all day and like not exercising and not moving around, it just like will seize on that. And my dad, because I think he's just where he is in his grief and all of that, he just doesn't do anything to help himself out. You know what I mean?
Well, like, it sounds rote, but it's the same thing with the grief. If you don't get out of bed and you don't move around and you don't have a reason to get through it, you're not going to get through it. How is your mother handling it? How's your mother dealing with it?
My mom is like totally the opposite. Like she is so active in it. She started this support group in Houston for family members who have lost loved ones to overdoses. And she does that. And she speaks, she does public speaking. She goes to high schools and talks to kids about it. She's written several articles about it. I mean, she's very active in it, and she's gone to extensive therapy, and now she's in a place where she travels and she loves my children. They are her reason for all of it. And so, you know, she's doing really well. I think that the thing with my dad is really sad. I mean, they've been married almost 40 years and, you know, it sucks. It sucks. And I think this happens like with grief where you have one person who deals with it this way and you have another person who deals with it this way. And
totally,
you know, it's like, I mean, my dad definitely like loves the kids and, you know, it's funny because like my mom has been saying he's like been on Amazon, like buying all this shit for them for Christmas, for Santa Claus, you know? So like my husband will write the letter, but my dad is still the one that's like doing all the stuff behind the scenes. So like he's getting into it in his own way. But you know, it's like when you lose, like, so we had four people in our family, right? We had my mom and dad and me and Harris. When you lose 25%,
that's a huge loss. And it's also, it's like the balance goes is the thing.
Yeah.
You know, your balance 2-2 and becomes 2-1 and the balance changes. And I know your dad came on last day. How did that go?
I mean, he kind of like, I wanted him to come on in an actual real meaningful way. And then it was just like so funny how it happened because he refused to do it. Like I brought my mom on and I said, I really would like dad to come on. And she texted me later that night. Dad doesn't want to be interviewed. Sorry. And I was like,
wow.
Okay. So I went over to her house with my kit to have her record that because I was going to have her like play that on the show instead of having my dad do an interview. And I was going to be like, you know, it's hard for him. He doesn't want to talk about it, which is all true. And then he's literally in the background on the couch drinking shav, which is like this Jewish gross.
I know what shav is.
Okay. Well, for listeners who don't, it's fucking gross. And
it's gross. Describe it. Describe
it's like,
the
it's
shav.
Like liquid spinach. It's liquid spinach, basically. It's like cold liquid spinach.
Yeah.
Like he loves it. He like drinks it from the glass jar. But anyway, so he's like sitting over there on the couch. He's like, why aren't you interviewing me? I'm like, are you kidding me, dude? Like I'm here because you won't be interviewed.
And but that like, might be a big flash of his interest finally. Like that, does he talk about Last Day at all? Does he talk about what your mission is now?
Loves the show. He loves the show. Like when I was growing up, like with me and Harris, he was like, my dad wrote like medical textbooks, you know? So like having two kids in the arts, you know, like I remember like all my essays, he would just bleed red ink on it. You know, like, why are you using so many adjectives? You know, like just get to the period, make the point. And he's very like direct and concrete and science driven and fact based. And Harris and I were totally not. And, you know, very rarely is he like, I am unabashedly proud of you. You know what I mean? Like I am without, whatever, you know, I'm losing the word, but like, I'm proud of you. You've done good, kid. Like, it's just rare. And so like with the show, he's like, this is amazing. And I'm proud of you. You know, like I love the show and you know, he listens as soon as it comes out and I ended up like having him on very briefly where he basically said that he doesn't want to talk about his grief and he feels responsible, but he's not going to get into why. It was like such a my dad interview. I loved it. It was very charming. But then I ended up like having the Santa letter that we were talking about in the holiday episode. And I had read it and one of my producers was like, listen, this like, it's not totally working. Like, do you think he would read it? And I was like, I don't know. I can try. So I called him. I was like, hey, would you throw this on tape for me? And he was like, yeah. And so I went over and he did it. And I think he really enjoyed doing it. So he's like kicking and screaming, but I feel like it's almost like an act. I think he is like, you know, and I think like I do see a little sparkle in him right now. So I'm wondering if there's something like in hearing the show that he's feeling better. I don't know.
I know that my dad is not a doctor, but he was a science teacher, and my dad felt very disconnected, obviously, from me during the addiction. And my dad didn't really like Dopey for a long time. It made him very uncomfortable. But now he's fucking obsessed with it. He dies to come on. He reads every review. He's just totally in it. And when I think about your dad, though, as a doctor, as somebody who understands the beneficial, you know, aspect of sharing or shared grief or emoting, like that it has proven medical results, I'm surprised he doesn't see like that it could help him. And maybe what you're doing now could be a great rope-a-dope for him to feel what he's feeling, you know, without suppressing it. You know, it might be this unearthing of emotion through listening.
I mean, I hope so. That would be the best outcome, you know? I mean, totally. I hope so. Yeah.
And when you do the show, like what, like that review was amazing. Do you hear from a ton of people? Like, are you in touch with a lot of like people who are in similar situations as you?
Yeah. I mean, we get just so many emails from people who want to talk about this stuff, you know? And the second part of the season that we're working on now is us telling a lot more of these stories. So, you know, like the first episode back, we've got a couple who are living in LA. They're like in their early 30s. They've got two kids and he's like very newly sober. He's doing a methadone program and like he never went to outpatient. It's like in his neighborhood and, you know, he's working, he's going to AA and he's, you know, doing the steps and, you know, so we're hearing from them, but like we know them because they wrote into the show. So,
right.
You know, so like it's this interesting thing that's happening now where we're getting our stories for the second part of the season from our listeners, which is like, that was always kind of the idea, is that people would hear the show, they would feel whatever they felt, we would hear from them, and then we could tell their stories as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's another thing we have in common, that like, a lot of our content just comes from our audience, which is why like things like this like make podcasting like an actually almost spiritual thing, definitely a community-based thing. And it's really cool, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I love the part about podcasting that I love is that I get to do it by myself. Like I can do it in the studio by myself, in my pajamas, whatever. But then like we take that and it becomes this totally other thing, you know, once it like hits people and like people say like, oh, it feels so intimate, but like there is something like when somebody's like in your head, like you have like an earbud in your ear and like you're hearing them on this one-on-one thing. Like it is very spiritual. I'm going to echo you on that.
Well, good. It's good that you echo me. And I think it's also like, I mean, I'm amazed at your production. You know, you guys, I mean, like I do the opposite thing. And I have one sort of producer, but my producer just listens and then tells me what's bad or tells me what's good. He's not making anything.
Right.
He's more of like, yeah, I don't think you should do that again, Dave.
He's like your very sort of like low budget quality control department. He's like,
yeah, and he
QC.
Well, he'll get very upset if he hears you say that. Sam is irreplaceable. He's incredibly
very
helpful.
Expensive, high budget QC department. of the...
Well, I don't pay him. That's the other thing. Sam doesn't get any money. Sam does it because Sam's in recovery.
Yep.
And it's he gets those spiritual dollars. And he and I believe one day the great monetary wave will hit Dopey and he will sort of benefit. And he
for
will.
Sure.
If the monetary wave ever breaches our bow,
yeah,
then he will definitely benefit.
Yeah,
But I love you the way you guys tell stories. And I love what you're doing for our community. And if the Dopey Nation hasn't listened to Last Day, you guys will love it. I mean, I've heard from a bunch of people in our community that do love it and do listen. So I think that's amazing.
Well, I do. What I do like is that, like, I'm always worried. I'm a Jewish woman, so I'm always worried. But I'm worried that it's going to skew in one direction. Like, I'm always very, very cognizant of and sensitive to not ever shaming anyone and to, like, talking about this in a way that is extremely free of judgment. And because I love my brother more than anybody, right? Like, he is still, like, my favorite person, and he was somebody who used drugs. So, like, I love people who use drugs. You know what I mean? Like, I always want to, like, make sure that if somebody's coming at it from where you are, that they feel represented in a way that feels fair. And what I've loved is that, like, we're not just getting feedback from people who are loving people like that, but from actual addicts who are saying, like, thank you, I'm able to play your show for my blah, 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 blah. And, like,
right,
they like, get it now. Like, they feel, like, this one person was like, oh, I played it for my wife or husband or whomever, and they came and gave me, like, this huge hug, and they were just like, I love you, and I, like, get what you're going through. It was like, okay, like, that's fucking awesome.
I mean, that's everything. When I first reached out to you, were you like, who the hell are these idiots doing this show? Like, did you think for a second that we were, like, not, like, actually dealing with addiction in a way that could be helpful to the community for a second? Were you like, why am I going on this cockamamie show?
I, like, it's crazy because you, I don't know how, because didn't you, like, DM me on Twitter?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, and, like, I'm so bad at responding on any internet platform. Like, I'm truly bad at it, and I always feel shitty about that. But I don't know what you said that, like, made me think, like, oh, yeah, I want to do that. I don't know, because, like, typically my response would be like, no, I'm good, you know?
Right.
And I was, like, very pregnant, too.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, like, maybe you said something about Harris. I think it was you said something about Harris. Anybody can, like, if you say something nice about Harris, like, that's my, I'm like, okay.
Well, the thing was that I had heard, and me and Stephanie had just recorded for Last Day, and I didn't mention this. There were a couple things I didn't mention on your show that I wanted to mention. One of which was that Harris was on Pete Holmes's podcast called You Made It Weird, and somebody had sent it to me, and I heard it, and I was like, wow. I was like, this is kind of a proto-Dopey episode. It was like Harris talking about struggling, talking about using, talking about relapse, and doing it in an unabashed, honest, non-judgmental, non-shameful way.
Yeah,
and it was just,
incredible.
It was like, it was a total crack in the universe for me where I was like, this is totally possible. You know, and then the other thing that I didn't talk about on your show is just like how important our community is to us, you know, but whatever.
Yeah,
we'll get there. You tell them.
Yeah.
You tell them.
I will tell them. I will put it in the scripting. Don't you worry. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what you said. And I said, like, yeah, let's do it. And then I remember, like, it was late. I think it was late, right?
It was late.
Yeah. And I was tired. And, like, I'm telling you, like, anytime I have to get on the phone, I'm like, oh, God, why? And then I started talking to you, and I really, like, I enjoyed you. I thought you were great. And then, you know, you sort of, like, revealed there was other stuff going on that I didn't know about. And, you know, and then I guess we kept in touch. Or how did we get back in touch?
No, because Jessica, your producer, had heard the Dopey story on This American Life. And she said to you, I think this should be on Last Day. And you were like, I know that guy.
Yes. Oh, my God. That's what happened. Yes. Okay. So she sent me, or somebody sent me this article about Chris dying. And I remember I had to pull over because I felt like my chest was going to explode. I felt like, I think I have like very intense PTSD. I think I probably need to get this addressed like in an actual real way. But I do like, I joke about not liking the phone, but I do think I have like an actual fear of the phone ringing, like that I need to work through. And I always feel like people are going to be calling me with bad news. You know, and so I'm always like, I'll say to people like, is that something you feel, or is that abnormal? Like, let's just check in. Do you think that that's weird, or is that something that everyone feels? And they'll be like, no, I don't think everyone feels that way. And I'm like, all right, fair enough. But yeah, she sent me the article, and I remember I pulled over and I felt like this just heaviness. And I felt like, oh my God, like I was on that show. Like I just talked to these guys. And they're
not to mention, if you read anything about Chris, it sounds exactly like Harris. And it becomes this, you reliving the same thing. Cause it's the same story. It's the same story for anybody, you know, who has a brother who's young and lovely and handsome and smart, and they die. It's like, it's the same story, which is the craziest thing, that they're all the same story, but they're all equally painful to everybody that experienced them.
Exactly. You know? It's like there's a true like universality to it. It's like your story is my story. And that has been so true doing the show and doing this whole process. But yeah, she sent me that, and I was like, I just felt like, so, I don't know. My heart was just like breaking for you. I just felt like I was like, I don't know. I just got really sad for you. And I was like, yes, they definitely need to come on the show. And I know this guy and he's great. And then I was like, I had this panic because I was thinking like, we have babies that are the same age, because your wife was pregnant, or like your kid was born in like May, right? Like the same time Harry was born. And so I had this first moment of panic where I was like, I couldn't remember which one was which.
Right.
And I was like, oh, no. Like I thought that
Chris had the baby.
And, and then I was like on the side of the road, like Googling and making sure it was, you know, and I just, I don't know. It just felt, I still feel really bad and sad for you guys. And why bad and sad are the only words I can think of. I have a podcast. I have a show. Bad and sad.
No, your podcast is a bad and sad podcast. I think that that's like the thing, though. It's like you lose words. You pull over on the side of the road. I remember I met this woman who was friends with my friend Todd, and she hadn't seen Todd in 15 years, and she was listening to the This American Life piece, and she heard his voice in the piece, and she realized it was him, and she had to pull over on the side of the road because that's how she found out. And something like that, it becomes so crazy how some story is so little to you, but is everything to the next person. And it's the same story, and how powerful it can all be. It's just, it's nuts.
Yeah.
The whole thing is nuts.
No, it is. It is. The whole thing is very nuts. Yeah, that's true.
But I'm very happy to have you in our orbit and to be in yours. I think it's fucking cool. And I mean, I think we should do periodic check-ins and stuff.
I would love that. I would love to do periodic check-ins. I actually legitimately enjoy talking to you. So
I do too. Good.
I'm good with that.
So let me know if you're ever in New York. Okay. We'll get coffee.
Oh, I will. Yes. I was actually in New York, in your neighborhood. I was in New York recently, and it was an In-N-Out kind of a deal. But yes, the next time I'm there, I will holler at you. We will have a
I'll buy you a pastrami sandwich or something.
I would love nothing more than that.
All right, cool. How's your mom doing with it? I mean, so you're saying your mom has been able to deal with the grief way differently than your dad and is moving through it.
Yeah, my mom is good, and I feel like we, you know, it's always something that sucks. I mean, I was telling you earlier, it's like this weird thing has happened where the worst thing happened in the world. And then as a result of that, all of these other things have happened that I never
right.
could have anticipated. And like
right.
my worldview as a human has fundamentally shifted. And I think my mom is in that same boat. Like, I think we both are these chronic worriers and these like anxiety people, and we want to like try to control everything and make sure everything is the way that we want it to be. And then it's like, well, actually, like, you can't. That they're like, my mom was the best mom. She was the best mom. She was always the room parent and the PTO president and was on every field trip and was just loving and available. And there's, she was great. Like Harris would always say, like when I was in therapy, they'd be like, what happened to your childhood? And you'd be like, nothing. I had a fucking great childhood. Like
right.
my parents were wonderful to me. And my dad was a little absent, but like whose father is it? You know, like, you know, it was like a totally typical kind of an upbringing. And, you know, Harris still died. And so it's like, I think that my mom has been able to sort of let go a little bit. And, you know, she's grown in a bunch of ways that I wish like she hadn't had to, you know, but she has. And same with me. It's like, you know, I'm probably like exponentially more chill now than I was
right.
before my brother died, because, you know, when he died, I was like, oh, okay, so we all die and we're here for 1 second.
Right.
And nothing fucking matters.
Right.
Like, and I felt that way for a long time, like in a very negative sense, like nothing matters. But then I was like, oh, well, if nothing matters, then I can just do whatever the fuck I want, you know, like in terms of like creatively or quitting my job that I hate or like not spending time on things that I don't want to be doing that aren't.
Well,
like,
life is so short that what matters is trying to enjoy it. You know,
yes.
that's what
yes.
matters.
And that's a weird thing to come to after the worst thing that happens to you, you know?
Well, the really fucked up way to look at it, and I hate to say this, and it's like, and it's almost biological, that when somebody dies, the earth benefits from its body going into the ground. Flowers pop up, you know, animals get to get nourishment. And with your brother, it created spiritual nourishment for the world through your podcast. As fucked up as that sounds, you know,
yeah.
it's just... And I don't mean to be dire about it, but you're bringing spiritual nutrition to a hungry fucking country and world. So how's that?
I just truly like heard you say that, and then I heard Harris hearing it, and it was great. I loved all of that, what that just happened in my head.
Good.
I love that. Yeah. No, that's good. That's very good.
Do you remember, like, when you talk about Harris in therapy and this kind of stuff, do you remember him ever giving a reason why he would get high? Like, do you remember his reason?
I mean, he always loved getting high. Like, he
yeah.
made such a deal about being a recreational drug user. It was part of his brand. You know, he was like, I love going to fish shows. And I, like, he went on Marc Maron's podcast and, like, they talked about how much he liked using drugs. And, like, why can't I just be a recreational drug user? And,
right.
you know, like, I think that he like had no ability to pump the brakes on anything he did. Like he was just extreme in terms of everything. Like just
he was an addict. You know, he was a fucking addict.
Overindulgent in every fucking way. Yeah. And like my mom and I were talking about it the other night. She was like, God, what was she telling? Maybe she was telling me she was listening to, oh, this is what she was saying. She was listening to Analyze Fish, which was this show
yeah.
that he did with Scott Aukerman. And she was like, I found out that he was doing all of these drugs when he was like 12 that I didn't know about. And
right.
I was like, yeah, Mom, like I was too. I mean, we both were, you know? And she was like, but, you know, like this conversation always comes up like, well, you didn't turn into that, you know? And it's like, no, because that's not how I am wired, I guess. I don't know. Like, when I got to college, I was like, okay, like, I'm done here. You know, like, I've done all that, and I'm good. I'm going to stop now because I need to, like, do all these other things I need to do. And
it didn't do the same thing for you that it did for him
no,
or that it did
no.
for me. You know, it did something no. for me that I didn't want to live without it. You know, I couldn't live without it, you know, for a long time.
Well, and I think the other, like, my understanding of Harris's, like, existence in his world being in LA and, you know, he worked for Parks and Recreation. He had this, like, very big job and he was...
The show, not the city group.
The show yes. on NBC. And yes. he made money by being funny and creative, right? And so, and, like, he was rejected. I mean, a million times. Like, he would spend 6 months to a year, like, pouring his entire being into, like, this pilot, and then it would just get scrapped, you know? And I think that kind of pressure, like, he was very chill. Like, his rhythm was very chill as a human, but, like, inside, internally, I think it was hard. And he started at 22. Like, he was a kid. He got started in this, like, pressure cooker at 22. So between 22 to 30 is when his drug use, like, really picked up. And I think that he needed something to turn all of that off, to, like, shut it off. And I think that became drugs.
Heroin, opioids.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a very similar thing happen to me. I wasn't, like, a big fish guy, but I was a big Dead guy. And I loved smoking pot and tripping and all that. But it wasn't until I was in entertainment and producing and hosting a show that I found that heroin really helped with the anxiety of it. Like, it made me feel calm and safe. And I did it to deal with the neuroses of having to do a show and feeling pressure and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that's good. Thank you for confirming that my hypothesis is correct. I can't ask him, but this
no.
is just what I think. I don't know if
Well, right. you know, he didn't say I'm broken. He said I like to get high and I feel a lot of pressure. You know,
yeah.
and he probably was protecting himself the way we all do. I mean, all of us addicts are just different versions of each other. I mean, all people are. You know, addicts just happen to be like one amalgam of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I really do love that both of our shows exist in this kind of sphere and mirror each other in our weird funhouse Stranger Things way. I think it's good.
Me too. I love cool. that I'm in the upside down with you. I enjoy that is the case.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. And
you
if you ever need anything, you let me know.
I will. Same.
All right, cool.
Okay, bye.
Bye. So that was a total pleasure to have Stephanie on the show. Supposedly, I will be on Last Day in February. I'm very excited about that. And in other news, there's a very, very good chance that today, Friday, This American Life will be rerunning their Dopey episode. So if you guys haven't listened, go check it out. Unless they fucking Welch and it's not up there. But I think it's going to be up there. So I'm very, very, very excited about that. All right. I love reading Dopey emails. So here is a Dopey email from a dude. His name is Zach. Its subject is a revolting podcast with a wretched, vile host. Just kidding. While I haven't listened to every episode, I've listened to enough to know that subject line would likely catch your attention. Dave, Dopey is, in fact, the best podcast I've come across, and I love you, dude. Anyhow, with the pleasantries out of the way, I just wanted to say hi and pick your brain a bit. I first learned about Dopey several months ago while listening to another pretty good drug podcast, Psychotropic, and have been avidly working my way through all of your content right from episode 1. Today, I just finished episode 111. Initially, your podcast was a simple activity that kept me entertained on my commute, but over time, it has transformed into a ritual that I genuinely look forward to every day. More importantly, it has me reflecting on my recovery and considering how to move forward with the most success. As a nearly 31-year-old who picked up a taste for intoxication in my mid-teens, I've spent half of my life hobbling around on the crutch known as addiction. My progression from recreational use to full-on afflicted status was slow but thorough, spanning across every drug most people can name and a few most people haven't even heard of. The only exceptions being PCP and acid. Once I picked up opiates, things got ugly. Shortly after meeting my wife, I made a concerted effort to try and quit. I struggled for a couple of years and eventually found myself using nothing but Kratom. For a long time, I considered myself clean and doing well, but I can tell you firsthand that Kratom is not the innocent plant a lot of people make it out to be. Frankly, its availability and the consistently perpetuated misinformation in regard to its effects, both positive and negative, make it a downright dangerous drug that many people fall victim to. People call it opiate light, which does accurately reflect the high, but not the addiction. Let me tell you a short story as an example. Around this time last year, I decided to quit once and for all again. I started a taper schedule and booked some time off work, at which point I planned on going cold turkey. Although it was tough, I did manage to reduce my dose over the course of several weeks with a careful yet still incredibly uncomfortable taper, and when my time off arrived, I dumped all of my remaining stash in the garbage bin outside. Over the next 7 days or so, I white-knuckled it through the inevitable withdrawals. Things were looking up, but despite the suffering I endured, one of those visceral, nothing-gonna-stop-me cravings hit. Without hesitation, I went outside, started pulling the entire week's worth of garbage out of the can, diapers, cat litter, etc., until I got to the pile of green powder at the bottom. I shit you not, an entire colony of maggots took residence in the pile of Kratom, but I didn't give a fuck. I took my spoon, scooped up a dose, picked the maggots out, and ate the shit. I'm sorry. Within days, I was shooting dope and coke again. Anyhow, I was lucky enough to have one of those dude, what have you become moments, and decided to take a different approach to recovery. I came clean with my wife and family, called my doctor, and began my first foray into recovery with the help of actual professionals. Since that day, I began to work on my actual issues, and I could proudly say I am doing better than I have in decades. It's not all sunshine and roses, though. I've been on Suboxone just under a year now, patiently tapering down with an end goal of zero. I also smoke weed most evenings after the kids and wife go to bed and take an SSRI daily. The first few months of this new plan, of this new path to recovery, yielded great results, but I feel as if I reached a plateau. Something is still not right in my life, and I am not sure what it is or where to find it. I kept myself isolated for years and have very few social interactions outside of my family and what's necessary at work. I feel lost. I'm not sure this sense of drive I used to have is missing, and I want to have it back. I've always poked fun at 12-step meetings and such, but listening to your podcast has me seriously considering trying my hand with the fellowship. I am scared, though. I am not a spiritual or religious person, and the whole Suboxone weed things has me a feeling ashamed to go feeling. My plan at the moment is to finish this Suboxone taper, at which point I'd like to try putting aside the weed for a few months and diving headfirst into AA or NA, just to see where it takes me. I'd also like to come off the SSRI. Do you think I'd benefit or be welcome to popping into some meetings before I can actually claim sobriety? I don't know what I'm looking for, but I need to find it, and I figure this would be a great place to start. I was also curious how the rooms view drugs like Vivitrol. And do you have any tips for an indecisive mindset? For example, some days I am really excited about this plan, and other days I am like, fuck it. Last but not least, have you done a Kratom episode yet? As I mentioned before, I am only at episode 111, so I have some content to go through, but I'd love to share my knowledge and experience with the drug. As always, keep up the good work and stay strong, Zach. And his nickname is The Ripped Trojan. And I love that email, and I'm just going to answer as quickly as I can, Zach. I totally think you should go to meetings. I don't know what the rooms think of Vivitrol, but I would imagine that they look at it very positively. They don't particularly look positively on Suboxone or weed, but that's not the point. The point is for you to find, you know, your happiness again. And, you know, for me, it came once I stopped using all mind and mood altering substances. I would definitely go to a meeting. You'll probably hate it at first, but that could change. And if you go, just know that going to a meeting isn't going to really do it. What's going to do it is actually doing the program, which is working the steps. But go to a meeting. I don't know if I wrote you back or not. I hope you're still listening. I'll write you back after I finish the recording. I love the email. Thank you. I also want to thank, there's a guy in Louisiana named Price who's big in the Dopey Nation. he sent me a fucking Stratocaster, and I have to thank him. And I know that Price is incredibly ambivalent, kind of like Zach. And it's like I've been hearing from a ton of people in the Dopey Nation who are really struggling to stop using or are struggling because they're on Suboxone. You know, what I say to anybody is, I mean, I shared about it at a meeting today. Like, it is impossible for somebody to tell you how not to be a drug addict or how to get clean. I was very, very lucky that it hit me, you know, that recovery hit me, and I embraced it, and then I did what I had to do to keep it. But if it doesn't hit you, you should keep hitting yourself into it, because eventually it could. And the flip side, obviously, is eventually the drugs could kill you. You know, they killed Chris, they killed Todd, they killed Dave Marshall, they killed Andrew, it's just, they've killed more people than we can count. Tina's friend, there's a million people who have been casualties of this thing. So if you have any inclination to quit, I totally recommend doing anything possible to do it. But thank you for the guitar. I'm very excited to plug it in and letting it rip. Also, there's an incredibly sweet woman on Twitter who stopped by my job and left me iced cookies. Thank you to you. And anybody who gives me anything, if I didn't mention it, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And then anybody who's ordered something that I haven't shipped out, I'm doing a big shipping this week, but remind me if it seems like a long time. Please let me know. Here is the review of the week. I implore you to go on iTunes and leave a 5-star review. It makes my dad really happy. Chris in heaven will be happy. He loved reviews. Here is the review of the week. It is from Oppenheimer's Girl. We need more alt recovery, 5 stars. Thank you to Dave and Dave's dad for your consistent work. I began listening back. My dad doesn't really work that hard on this thing, just so you know. I began listening back when Dave and Chris were tracking down Todd's sightings. I was a little on the fence. To come back with both Todd and Chris gone changes everything. Dave shows amazing fortitude and levity in the face of crippling adversity. Recovery in action. The rooms have become terrible, antiseptic, all or nothing. Dopey allows addicts to come as they are. Some of us came, then came to believe. Long live the Dopey Nation. Toodles for Chris. So yeah, leave a 5-star review. I would love that. I want to thank everybody for everything you've done. Dopey is nothing without the Dopey Nation. Thank you to Andrew and Catherine and Paulina and Leah, the administrators of the Dopey Nation fanbook page. Thank you to Cormac for running Reddit. Love Cormac. Send in a new song, Cormac, you fuck. Thank you to Sam for all of his tireless efforts. Thank you to my friend Brad for everything he does. Thanks to my dad, to Linda. Happy New Year, Dopey Nation. Also, quickly, I want to thank Liquid Death Water. They sent me 2 cases of fucking water and tall boy cans. And fucking Stumptown Coffee sent me a box full of delicious goodies, including Hairbender Coffee, which is one of my favorites that I French pressed this morning. Anyway, hope you guys are good. Fucking Happy New Year, everybody. Before I forget, coming up is Dopey Day, where everybody involved with the show covers their eyes in solidarity around Dopey, addiction, recovery, whatever you want. It's vague. I don't know when it's going to be. But it's coming up, Dopey Day. Look out for it. We'll say, stay strong, Dopey Nation, and fucking toodles for Chris.
I want to take a walk around the world. I wonder would it do me any good. Until I get some money in my pocket, then I guess I'll just have to walk around my neighborhood. But I want to be good so bad. Want to be so good, so bad, so bad. I want to be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And I want to take a ride up in the sky. Watch as airplanes just pass me by. And I want to see a Lear jetliner take a dive. Just to show all of these people what it means to be alive. But I want to be good so bad. Want to be so good, so bad, so bad. I want so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. And my shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. Shadow's getting smaller and smaller. And it's time to where I stand. And I wonder would they pay it any mind when I leave this busted city far behind. I'll take the high road, however far it winds, because peace and love are very, very, very hard to find. And I wanna be good so bad. Wanna be good so bad, so bad. I wanna be good so bad. Bad desire's all I ever had. Damn it, all these suckers make me mad. And it's all I ever had. And it's all I ever had. And these suckers make me mad. And I want to call my dad. And it's all I ever had. 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 And these suckers make me mad. And it's all I ever had.